Have you ever met someone who's truly all good or truly all evil?
No, I have not.
Tom Hanks is pretty close to pure good, but close as we, you know, with major flashes of evil.
Thank you for joining us for another exciting episode of The First Podcast.
My name is Lars. I'm your main host and editor. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Joe.
Hi.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. How are you, Lars?
Well, I'm doing really well because I just happened to get someone on the call tonight. Oh, his name is Vijay Lakshman. You may or may not have heard of him. He's just responsible for the creation of this video game series called, I don't know, Elder Scrolls.
Oh, what?
You may have heard of that. You may have not. A lot of people on the internet, let me just preface this by saying that a lot of people are excited for this episode. We got the Discord waiting in the bullpen to be able to hear this released. I'm going to get it out as soon as I can. Got you promoted on Reddit on the Elder Scrolls subreddit. Shout out to all of you guys. And there's a lot of anticipation going. I was admittedly surprised when I saw an email in our account saying, do you guys want the creator of the Elder Scrolls to come join you on the first podcast? And I said, yes. So we would love to talk to you about that. We also would like to talk to you about Mythborn, which is your book series that you're working on right now, which you seem to also want to turn into a multimedia franchise with video games, movies, graphic novels, so we can get into that as well. And anything else that comes up, I guess. And I've been kind of hogging the mic, so I'd like to start us off by asking, Vijay, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I hope we have enough time for that. I am I'm an Uber geek, and I think ultimately I managed to last through the number of years where being a geek and a nerd was bad, and I've somehow come out the other side where now it's sort of cool.
A little bit, yeah.
But I ultimately, when I was a kid, I loved video games. I loved D&D. I loved Traveler. I loved these tabletop pencil and paper role-playing games. And, I used to be yelled at by my mom all the time, who, of course, because I'm of Indian background, she said, they'll never get you a job. You'll never be a doctor. You'll never be a doctor without. And anyways, I ended up, it turns out that in my first interview, and luckily it was at Bethesda Softworks, the lead programmer said to me, hey, what do you know about Traveler? And I knew the rule book inside and out. And then he said, what do you know about D&D? And I knew it inside and out. I literally got my first job in the games industry because of playing pencil and paper role-playing games all through high school. So who am I? I'm just a kid who somehow lucked into the dream job, right?
And then a multi-million dollar franchise was born.
That's right.
So, yeah. So did you go back to your mom and after you got that job and say, hey, I got the position. What they asked me? How much I know about D&D?
Yeah.
You know what else they asked? If I know about Traveler.
Every holiday when she gets on my case, I have that in my back pocket.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, at this time, was Bethesda, this was kind of at their beginning, right? This was before they were well known, or had they been going for a little while?
No, actually, they had been successful as a tiny, tiny game company. They had done a game called Wayne Gretzky Hockey, and people loved it. And they were working actually at the time on a game called NCAA Road to the Final Four, which was the first game I was a producer on. And when I joined the company, my production team and I were 7 people in a townhouse. Now, now Bethesda's like 300, 400 people plus their studios. They're a $1 billion company or more. But at the time, we were in a small townhouse in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And, you know, I mean, everything I learned because there weren't enough people to do all the jobs. So I ended up basically, you know, doing every job I could and learning, you know, how to do them.
Did you have a background in computer programming, or was this kind of just like learning on the fly?
Well, as you recall, you asked about me being a background in computer programming. If you recall, I basically ended up I was a pre-med student, right? And I had done a lot of, you know, science and biology and chemistry and things like that. But my only background in gaming was pencil and paper role-playing games. And so, yes, I mean, I probably had an ability with, you know, math and things like that. But for the most part, I was really, really focused on sort of, you know, trying to get into med school. And so, no, I didn't have any programming background whatsoever.
From what I can tell, it seems like when you guys first started on The Elder Scrolls, it was intended more as an action game. But then at some point you switched over to RPG. And obviously that was your wheelhouse, so I'm sure you were excited for that. But what caused the switch, and, you know, what were you guys going for with that?
You've nailed the biggest and first failure of my life, right? So, so let's dive into it. So,
okay.
First of all, I wasn't a programmer ever, right? My job was what people might consider today to be a dream job, which was I was the idea guy. I was the designer. I was the one who came up with, like, what the world or the characters would be and how it would all work.
So you were the game master.
I was, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Game master of the Elder Scrolls, or game master of Nirn, I suppose, right?
Is that how that's pronounced? Of Tamriel,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening was I and who's now my best friend, Julian Jensen, who at the time, Julian LeFay, he was the lead programmer on Elder Scrolls 1, 2, and 3, I think. He and I were sitting outside one day, literally saying, what should our game be after NCAA Road to the Final Four? And he had always wanted to do an RPG, and so did I. And I said, you know, I saw this movie, and it had Rutger Hauer in it, and there was this girl, and they threw stones at a shield while they took a dog skull and tried to, like, score points with it.
Hmm.
And he was like, Blood of Heroes. And I was like, yeah, that. Let's make a game called Arena where you have a team that goes in and tries to score points against another team. And let's do sort of gladiatorial, gladiatorial manager, because we just gotten done with Hockey League Simulator, which is a big Hockey League management simulation game for people who wanted to just manage hockey league teams but not actually play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, oh, why not let people play this really fun combat game, but also have all the back, you know, the backdrop of, like, managing gladiators and things like that. And I recall very fondly sitting outside on spring days just talking about, like, would they go here? How do we generate the world? Are we going to use fractals? I mean, it was cool, and he's a brilliant dude, so, you know, I was very lucky to be partnered with him. But then, ultimately, you know, Bethesda was a small company. We didn't have a huge budget. We were, of course, over schedule. We were late. Around month 13, I had a team of about 6 people, maybe 7, working on the project. And we realized we couldn't get done with sort of the giant ambition of the what we'd started with. And so we're like, well, how do we get this thing to ship? And so I was already a writer at the time. I'd been writing a ton of backstory for Elder Scrolls. And I was like, you know what? Let's actually tie in this backstory behind, you know, not a team, because team means AI, and AI is more difficult. So let's make it a single player game, and let's have you adventure to try and put together these 7 pieces of the Rod of Septim, which would stop this Jaeger Thorn, right, from ruling the world. And so we created a story around the game. And I got to tell you, honestly, like, when I started in the games industry, one of the big mistakes most gaming companies do is do the story first, and then they do the coding. And ultimately, if you do the story first, you do a bunch of animation and film and sizzle reels and other things around that story. But then when you get closer to finishing you can't get all that stuff in, and so you have to throw quite a bit of it away. What I did correctly because of a mistake was design the game first. It was working, and then we layered story on top of it. And that was actually a much better way to go.
So what are the aspects that you designed first? Like the dynamics of how everything interacts with, like how the player interacts with the world and basically like the mathematics of it before the adding in the story, essentially, is what you did?
Actually, no. What I, my favorite game of the time was the Ultima Underworld series. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Ultima, right? And, yeah, and you know, I think it was huge. And what I wanted to do was create a character generation system that didn't necessarily need numbers, but instead you could answer moral questions, and based on how you answered those questions, we would offer you a character class.
That was a great idea. I did that to I was playing the game today, actually, just for fun. Like, oh, I should play it, and it's free on Bethesda's website, so I gotta check it out. Yeah, there was the 10 questions. Like, I opted for that instead of, like, trying to select one and manipulate it. And, yeah, it led me to, I think it was the Rogue. And
that's cool.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. And I guess that was quite novel at the time, right?
Oh, I mean, I think it was maybe, I don't know if it was original. Maybe Underworld did something close to it. I can't remember if I was first or they were first. But I will tell you that from a writer's standpoint, it connected you to the character so much better, right? I mean, you felt like...
Yeah, within seconds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that's the first thing I tackled. The second thing I wanted to tackle was I hated how spells were... they were sort of canned, like, you know, in D&D you have, like, you know, magic missile and you have these sort of spells per level. I played a game called Champions. And I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but Champions is based on the hero system. And what they do is they don't care how your power manifests. You get to pick that part. What they care about is how many dice do you roll, how much damage do you do. So I could have a lightning bolt that did the same damage as your water fist. But, you know, they were both basically, you know, energy projection, right? And so I decided to make this thing called Spellmaker, and Julie and I worked really hard on trying to figure out how could we let people create their own spells.
Yeah, that's been a theme throughout the series, I've noticed.
Yep.
It's been interesting.
And so letting people create their own spells, I thought this allowed even a further customization of your character, because in my mind, what I think all of us do when we play RPGs, I could be wrong, but what I did was, I imagined myself in that world, but a better version of me, right? So I wanted to roll up a character that was more me than it was just a bunch of stats. So that's sort of how the whole thing got started. And, you know, because of one failure and because of a genius programmer and a lot of free time on my hands, we managed to start a franchise that today is, you know, the best role play game in the world. And I just want to take a side note right now and say, I worked on, you know, Elder Scrolls 1 and 2 in terms of, I'd done the design for Daggerfall. I don't know how much they used of it, but I had moved on. My career had sort of catapulted from Elder Scrolls and I had moved on to other projects. And all the credit for what Elder Scrolls is today, I would offer to Todd Howard and his team at Bethesda Softworks. They have rocked the boat when it comes to setting a standard for computer roleplay games. And I, you know, my hat's off to them. I am honored they still use my maps and, you know, it seems like, you know, some of my notes and stuff, but in general, whatever you see in there that you love today, Morrowind and onward, it really is, you know, the result of an amazing team there that has, you know, taken a small ember, you know, a spark I created, and then, you know, lit a city on fire with it.
Well, yeah, I think that's quite humble of you, but I also think it's obviously a lot of the original, the lore and the universe is owed to you as an individual as well. For example, from what I recall seeing, you came up with the name of the series, right?
Yes.
The Elder Scrolls. Can you tell us a little about that? Like, what was the inspiration behind it, or was there any? Because I know what the Elder Scrolls are today within the Elder Scrolls games, but what did it mean back then?
Well, you know, in all honesty, myself, the president of Bethesda, a guy named Chris Weaver, and Julian Jensen and I, we sat down and we're like, how do we create something? Okay, so let me back up 1 second. So my original vision of the Elder Scrolls was to follow what I had seen in D&D. And if you think about what D&D is, it's back then and even now, it's a core rule set and then there are a bunch of modules, right? What I wanted to do was create a core rule set in Elder Scrolls and then follow up with a bunch of small packs. So I had designed a castle called Mournhold, which was a vampiric castle, sort of like Ravenloft. I had designed, you know, these whole, like, things that happen on the open ocean. There were gladiatorial pits. There are all these tiny little packets that I wanted to release after Elder Scrolls that would... that people could buy individually, right? So way before DLC, I had this idea of DLC.
Way before,
right? And so my idea was, you know, let's do DLC, let's do it right at the time, and let's do what TSR at the time and the rest have done so well, which is, you know, creating this amazing, amazing world that you could constantly sort of update and you know, keep live and keep fresh. And that was the plan. So even though when Elder Scrolls launched, it wasn't super deep, it wasn't intended to be super deep. It was intended to be the rule set upon which we could layer more and more adventures. And you know what? If you want to do Lair of the, you know, Black Dragons and someone else wanted to do, you know, the Sword Coast or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You sort of pick how you wanted to extend your world by buying individual DLC things. But at the time, you couldn't download them.
Right.
So anyways, Elder Scrolls was supposed to be reflective of that. When we sat down, we said, how do we create something that sounds like a tome, T-O-M-E, that can be expanded on over time? And it was the Elder Scrolls.
So it's kind of symbolic in a way. It's like it's representative of the series idea as a whole. Is you wanted this giant tome that could come through in different ways. That's kind of cool. I think a lot of people are going to be interested to hear about that. I think at one point I heard in a different interview that maybe the name was just created just as an afterthought. But it sounds like there was actually a lot of thought put into that. So that's kind of cool. Gives some context to where you're trying to go with the series.
Yeah. The downside was the world wasn't ready for that. You know, technologically. Yeah. Like, technologically, we couldn't.
You know. Oh, yeah, this was 1994 at the time. I mean, you couldn't just, you know, go to the Play Store and download a new thing for your app. It wasn't like that at all. One thing I did, just as a quick side note that was kind of amusing to me when I first started playing today, is there was voice acting in it. Like, that's really early for that. Even if it was just during the intro, it really caught me by surprise. Here I am listening to, like, MIDI music and, you know, 640 by 480 resolution on DOSBox, and then, someone's talking to me, which is kind of cool. I don't know. That's just a random aside. I feel like I'm kind of hogging the mic in terms of questions, by the way. Joe, do you have one to toss at him?
Well, I mean, I would be curious... were there any other elements that you really wanted to include in the game that was just completely impossible, where if you were to do it again starting from scratch now, you might include, besides, you know, DLC, like any other elements of gameplay or anything that you wanted to include back then?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? You may see this when we start releasing... you know, announcements on Mythborn.
Yes.
But
excited for
at
that.
The point, at that time, one of the things that Julian had come up with was how to use a fractal algorithm to generate a world. And the world he would generate was so friggin' cool. Like, it looked literally like a world, like a map with, like, height map, you know, bump maps that tell you, like, oh, how high mountains are. And he had set an algorithm that set up how it would like frost the mountains because they were over a certain height. Uh-huh. So things that grew over a certain height would have a white cap, and you know, things that were lower would turn deeper blue until eventually they'd be filled with water and that kind of stuff. It was really, really cool. And the cool thing there was at the time we had discovered that we could actually set a seed, like you'd say, you know, VJ, and you could put it in, it would generate the same world over and over again if you put a seed in. So what we had really wanted to do was create this sort of infinitely replayable world where after you finished Elder Scrolls once, you could reset everything, put a new seed in, or ask for a random seed, and an entirely new world would be built that had new landmasses, new islands, new everything. So in a way, in a weird way, it was sort of like the Universe Sim or like Spore, right?
Great game.
Yeah, a lot of cool concepts back then that we just didn't have the budget or the people to implement. But if I could do it again, I would, now that I have 85 game titles under my belt, I would know how to do it in a heartbeat.
Sounds to me like you actually have plans to actually do that when it comes to this Mythborn game, which we haven't really heard much about, but just in case the fans haven't heard, you are planning on taking that into the realm of video games, right?
Absolutely. I mean, look, Mythborn, my book, it's out now. I'm on book. We have 3 books out. The 4th book is about to come out. It's
We're
going
to talk about that in detail, by the way.
Sure.
But yes.
Yeah. But so, anyways, yes. The short answer to that is, I have 30 years experience now in building video games, and I retired from doing that so I could write full time. And for the last few years, I've been using all of the things I learned in building a world to build Mythborn. And so all the things that you love about Elder Scrolls, or you might love about, you know, any other games I've created, those lessons are now being applied. And I hope it's my opus, which is, you know, this amazing world I've built where you can adventure.
Beyond the Elder Scrolls world, though? I mean, that's not... I'm just saying, that's already quite an accomplishment, sir. I mean, you have an opus under your belt already. If you can do 2, that's great. I'm looking forward to it. But don't worry about going out without an impact in the world of video games. You have definitely established that.
I will tell you that I do think that the team at Bethesda deserves, you know, 80% of the credit, 90% of the credit on that. They, you know, look, ultimately, this is the first time that I've had a chance to have my imagination unleashed with a brain. With a brain that's not 22 years old, but a brain that's, you know, I don't want to say it, but much older. And I don't care, 51, right? But I'm doing this my whole life, right? So all the things, like, I'll give you a great example. I used to love fantasy. And then after a while, I got really tired of this idea of a guy sitting in a tall tower with a pointy hat, cackling and killing anyone who showed up with bad news. Like, it just was an unsustainable business model for a villain.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah, like, wasn't there some rule book for, like, evildoers, like the evildoers list where that's like a sin that you wouldn't commit, is just, like, kill people who give you bad news? Because, like, good henchmen are hard to come by, good messengers and stuff.
And the other thing was, my writing teacher when I was in college, they said to me, and I didn't think about it for like at least 10 or 15 years. And then one day, what she said to me really hit me. And she said, I think it's profound. She said, everybody is a hero in their story.
Hmm.
Like, the villain doesn't think he's a villain. He thinks he's doing a good thing for some reason. And you know what? If you apply that lesson against, flat characters in horrible fantasy, you can see the villains who are basically 2D characters designed just to be evil and not villains who have real motivation. So I would apply that, frankly, to Anakin Skywalker in the second, you know, series of things that were done by, you know, what you call it. But I'll tell you, a great villain was... I can't pronounce his name, but in Firefly, the remake of, you know, the Firefly movie,
Serenity,
that came out. Serenity, right? Yeah. The black guy that like was the swordsman, who was also an assassin. That is a great villain, right? Because he said to Mal, when Mal said, "What's our place in this world?" He goes, "I don't expect we'd ever live in this world. We're evil. We're not meant for this world. Our job is to change the world so it'll be better for everyone else. But I don't expect to live there." That's profoundly cool in my mind.
Yeah, I like it when there's depth given to the villain. I feel like it's really easy to not do that. And when I can kind of maybe sympathize or understand, at least if I don't agree with the villain, and see from their perspective. That's always interesting. And it sounds to me like you're kind of alluding to some of the things you're trying to do with Mythborn, which we should probably actually talk about directly. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what that series is and maybe just who the main characters are?
Sure. Yeah. So if I can just use three sentences to describe my context of mind before I started writing Mythborn.
Sure.
I think it will help people understand why I wrote Mythborn. So we talked about one, I can't stand villains without purpose. And they have to be a hero in their own story, right? In their own minds, they have to be a hero. Number two, I couldn't abide the sort of archetypical portrayal of women in chainmail bikinis hugging Conan's leg, right? Looking up at him while he held a sword aloft, you know, or whatever. Like, yeah. I didn't grow up with women like that. I grew up with, like, really tough, like, strong women. I'm a 40-year martial arts expert. I trained, you know, since the time I was 9 years old. I was number one in the U.S. twice in NASCA. And I fought, I've had 30-something thousand hours of training, right? So if you look at Glick and you say 10,000 hours is expertise, I've tripled that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the 10,000 hours mark, you've hit that well over. Yeah.
Right. So I've never had a situation where I would underestimate someone based on their gender. Like, it just doesn't happen in real life, right? You got to take everyone seriously.
Yeah.
And the third thing is I couldn't stand when people had no sort of... Have you ever met someone who's truly all good or truly all evil?
No, I have not.
Tom Hanks is pretty close to pure good, but close as we, you know, still with major flashes of evil.
In my normal life, I don't meet those kinds of people. So all the people in my book, they are shades of gray. They have good points to them, and they have bad points to them. But the way that you might measure whether or not they're good or evil is based on whether or not they're aligned to what you want.
This shades of gray scale you're measuring it on, is this a 50 shades of gray scale? Sorry, that was my dumb joke.
Yeah, it was.
It made me laugh. Yeah. I think that we'll circle back to that at some point.
Sure.
Yeah. So Mythborn, first of all, I wanted to have a world that made sense. So is it magical? Yes. But is the magical explainable? Absolutely, because, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but it's not a big deal. Certainly, if you don't want to hear this part, skip forward 10 seconds.
Editor's note, I'm going to go ahead and repeat that just in case you missed it.
If you don't want to hear this part, skip forward 10 seconds. The world's based on nanotech.
Hmm.
Okay, that's the end of the spoiler. You can go back to listening.
So think about, like, how magic then works, right? There are rules based on science, but because the rules themselves and how it's actually manifested, it feels like magic. And that's why the first quote in my book is from Arthur C. Clarke. It says, any, you know, sufficiently advanced, you know, you get it. So from there, I built a world that basically, the short story is, there's a kid who's training to be an assassin, and he finds out that his master has been ordered to kill him in the next 8 days. And he has to figure out how to survive, how to live, knowing that someone who knows much more than him has been assigned to kill him. And unbeknownst to both of them, as they leave for a mission in which Eric, the main character, believes he's being led to his death, when they leave on a mission, a second assassin, a younger, badass version of the master, who used to train with him but now is independent, she is sent after them to kill them both if his master fails.
So there's a lot of layers of conflict there going on at once, just right off the bat.
Yeah. And you know, ultimately, you got to ask yourself at some point, like, why would someone want to kill a kid, right? I mean, he's 16. What did he do? Well, it turns out that he has the ability to negate magic in this world by touching it.
Oh,
and And the reason why they want to get rid of him is because in the past, they would, this world, Eden, would constantly be invaded by demons through these rifts. But when the last huge war happened with the demon kind called the Eris, the king of that time said, hey, you know what? These mages, they're the ones who are causing all these problems. I'm just going to kill them all. That way, there's no way that these rifts will open and we don't have to worry about anything anymore. So he proceeds to create sort of like a magicide or a genocide against mages, right? And now, fast forward 200 years when the novel starts, there aren't many mages left. And lo and behold, a new gate opens. And the only way the few mages that are left can figure out what to do is they're like, hey, look, we have a choice. We don't have enough to stop an invasion of demons. But if you shove this kid through that gate, if he touches it, yes, he might disappear, but that gate will be gone. So everyone is trying to do the right thing, but not necessarily for the good of the, you know, the few, but for the good of the many, as Spock would say.
A utilitarian approach.
Philosophically complicated.
Exactly. Yeah,
interesting. So, okay, so the natural question here is you're planning on developing this into a video game series. Where does that, what would the player be doing in the universe if they were playing the video game?
So, you know, my idea, I've really sort of fallen in love with survival RPGs. I think it's amazing when you find yourself somewhere and you have to sort of craft your own world around you and then expand that reach. And so, given the basis of magic and where it's based on, imagine if what would happen today, let's say, for example, if the magic of your telephone failed. If the magic of your telephone failed, someone from Verizon would show up to figure out how to fix it, right? Or tech would be dispatched to figure out how to fix it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my idea was, what if a tech were dispatched to Eden and crash lands on the planet, a planet of dragons, mages, demons? They're amazing at managing the tech. They're amazing at, like, all that stuff. But they're on a world they've never been before that's incredibly dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? This terraforming, you know, what you start reading more and more into the book is you realize this is a terraforming mission that went wrong. And now, a millennia later, this is the world that's resulted. So I think that, you know, watching the actions of this character that you're going to play, trying to come to grips with how to get yourself back off planet, but also fix things while you're there, but also survive, that would be a very interesting RPG because, yes, you could take on the role of a knight or a rogue or an assassin or whatever you need to survive, but you are also, you have a higher meta game, right? The meta game is, I got to get off planet.
Oh, yeah, because you have a goal to actually to get out of there.
So if you've like played Breathe Edge or any of these latest sort of really, really cool, you know, I have 300 games on my Steam account, and I play every new game that comes out all the time. I'm constantly looking for new ways in which people are expanding the horizon space of the possibility space of how games are built. And so, you know, all of this is going into play when it comes to creating what I think is, you know, the next standard in an RPG, a computer RPG.
Of those games that you played, have you kept up on the Elder Scrolls series, like Skyrim?
Yeah, so when I left Bethesda, it wasn't on the best of terms. Mm. Bethesda at that time had been in a sort of like habit of going after employees that tried to leave. But to the credit of Bethesda, and particularly to the credit to Chris Weaver, we have, you know, sealed all those rifts. In fact, I'm going to be attending the Smithsonian's debut of another game being inducted to the Hall of Fame there on the invitation of Chris. And, you know, I can only extend, you know, such a thankfulness to being included in that kind of hallowed group. There's only 200 people or so being invited, and, you know, I'm one of the people being recognized as, you know, a guest who is influential in gaming. And, you know, I think for a while, I tried to avoid playing Bethesda games.
Well, yeah, understandably.
But I will tell you, I started playing Skyrim and loved it. I loved it. I thought they did such a great job. And, you know, I have only played Skyrim. I missed Morrowind. I only played Skyrim so far. Mm-hmm. My very good college buddy is the lead guy on Elder Scrolls Online. And so, you know, I constantly call him saying, should I get into this game or not? And he constantly tells me, you know, it's a time suck, right?
Joe plays that game. He can attest to the quality, I guess, of that game.
I
don't know
Elder
too much
Scrolls
about it.
Online. I haven't played the older ones. I want to play Skyrim. I think that Elder Scrolls Online is really fun. The only thing that I never really got into is crafting. I know that you can craft, and maybe I should get into crafting, but I guess I just don't really rely on potions or making my own weapons. I just kind of find stuff and go from there. Was crafting, I assume it was in the original, was it meant to be like how you get the main, like, the main equipment was through crafting, or has it always been like you can craft if you want to, but you don't have to kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I didn't know much about crafting when I was at Bethesda, but, you know, Matt is the lead over, he's the, you know, the guy in charge over Bethesda Online Studios. And Matt Ferrer and I'm like you. I'm not a big crafter. In general, right? Find cool things, right? But it is true that in any system, the crafting system will let you ultimately create better gear than you're ever going to find. And I think the problem is if you let everybody do it easily, then everybody would have amazing gear. And there's a concept in gaming called money sinks. And money sinks are this, right? Something most people don't normally think about. But if I have an economy and I don't have any place for you to lose money, it will be very, very quickly the entire world will be overrun with gold.
That concept is quite prevalent in World of Warcraft, which I used to play a lot. They'd have to have a lot of money sinks. Otherwise, players had too much gold and it just kind of got out of hand and it wasn't as fun.
That's right. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so, two purposes crafting solves is money sinks and also great gear. And they understand that there are only a few players who are going to get to that sort of legendary level of crafting. But to get there, they are, you know, and well, as they sell their equipment, they are ultimately the transactional basis for moving large sums of money from players into the environment, right? Buying new resources.
Yeah. By the way, just a side note, we actually have a lot of people listening in onto the call right now. Just wanted to give a shout out to them. We actually sent the link out to people and a lot of people are tuning in. So you're
cool.
You're not just reaching out to us. You're actually not live, because we'll go ahead and edit this afterwards, but you are effectively on air as it was. So
I love it. Yeah. I'm happy to be talking to the fans. And look, I mean, ultimately, the problem that I think you and I and, you know, all of us probably feel if we're not big crafters is it's just too big of an arc to get to the point where you get these awesome pieces of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, what you saw was this this sort of generation of auction houses. If you remember the early World of Warcraft stuff where people could start auctioning things, it was a big deal. People were all pissed off that you could, like, just buy something. You didn't have to build it or earn it. Mm-hmm. And now no one cares.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, so I think that much like with the real world, where I'm sure at some point people are like, wait a second, I can buy that horse, I can buy that armor or that sword that you spent all the time building for some gold in the real world. That bartering system of I don't owe you 3 sheep, I can just give you some coins. That mentality we have seen literally duplicated, even though we're present day modern people, we see duplicated in these MMOGs, right? We we see people going through the whole sort of very quaint idea of the barter system. And then, wait, coins? And then, wow, fuck it, I'll buy real money.
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, F it, I'll buy real money.
Oh, you can cuss all you want, by the way. This is not a radio show. We don't have FCC rules. The money sink is so it's very understandable. It's also very contentious. There are things I like about it. There are things that I don't. At the end of the day, it's like you want to save players, I guess, from themselves on some level. With that,
there's an interesting question that one of the people listening in is asking: have you ever put any of your old personal D&D characters as Easter eggs into any of the games and any of your games?
No. Yes. But interestingly enough, all through college, I played a paladin named Theoden. And what ended up happening was I ended up using the name Theoden as a backdoor on, I won't say which games, but certain games that I had done where if you get into the console and you could type in Theoden, you know, you got a different kind of console that gave you, you know, access to other things. But I stopped doing that actually after someone got sued in the gaming industry for putting Easter eggs in that weren't appropriate. And after that, there was this lockdown on everybody doing anything personal. There was a scrub system that went through and none of us were able to do that kind of stuff anymore.
Do you think that's going to bleed through into Mythborn the game and Mythborn the graphic novel, Mythborn the movie, Mythborn the franchise?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would tell you that Mythborn is 100% completely original for legal reasons.
Of course.
but you know, I mean, look, I mean, our lives are... We are a, you know, a patchwork of all the things that we've experienced in our lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, I got a chance when I was working on Elder Scrolls and other games to work with, like, the creator of Paranoia at Westwood Games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys were like old school pencil and paper developers, right? And, like, Ken Ralston, right? And those guys are just... They're just really, really amazing. And then when I was at FAST, I worked with Jordan Weissman, who's the creator of BattleTech. Like, literally, like, you're sitting next to the guy who now has done WizKids, and I can call him and be like, hey, am I doing something wrong here? And 9 times out of 10, I'm like, yeah, I don't even need to hear what you're doing. You're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, these are like, you know, giants upon which I got a chance to, you know, sit next to their shoulders, not even stand on their shoulders.
Well, I would consider you a giant from our perspective, so it's kind of like, it's just all relative, I suppose.
But, dude, I mean, imagine being the guy who created BattleTech, right? Yeah. I mean, that's just cool. Like, I just, whatever. So, and Jordan is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in your whole life. He is literally probably one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And you know, yes. Look, I mean, all of them, everything they've said to me is part of the games I make today. And is Mythborn, it's a product of all of those things. I mean, look, I wrote horrible, bad fantasy when I was young, right? And after about 1 million words of writing or more, I wrote 500,000 words of backstory for Mythborn before I even wrote the first novel. And so, you know, when I started writing Mythborn, I did my homework. I learned my lessons, and I understood how to build a world. Now, I will tell you this. When you start reading Mythborn, it starts reading just like a fantasy, just like any kind of normal fantasy. I don't dive deep into anything, and I never once explain the Force as Midichlorians, right? Like, I don't do that, right? It never comes up. I don't think that readers, I don't think anyone appreciates it that way, right? You know, no one will actually read in my spoiler. I mean, read what I, you know, said, hey, if you don't want to hear this, it's in the spoiler. Like, no one will read that in the books, right? What they do get the sense of as they read the lore and they're reading the books is hey, this is a much more complex and deeper world than I thought. And they can come to their own conclusions as to what the magic system is and how things work.
So you're kind of showing, yeah, not telling, specifically?
Exactly. Yeah. Always.
Got another one from the audience here, if you have a,
yep,
a minute.
Sure, yep. I have all the time in the world.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. So Arctic Freeze is mentioning, if you had the opportunity to, and you could do so peacefully, would you want to have some sort of creative input on a future Elder Scrolls game at some point? Or would you rather just kind of see them do their thing?
I mean, in all honesty, I'm a little intimidated by where they've taken the series. They have expanded it way beyond what I did when I was 20. And even at 51 now, you can't help but like look at the bully who beat you up and be like, oh man, he's still kicking my butt. Even though you're like, you might be a martial artist, right? So like at some level, I would always help them if they thought they wanted my help. And you know, I want to see Bethesda succeed, but I am a little bit in awe of what they've done. So you know, I would tell all the fans out there, look, I mean, check out Mythborn.
Okay. Yeah. By the way, sorry, go ahead.
No, just because it is what I would have done had I been left alone with Elder Scrolls.
Ah, right? Okay, I gotcha. So, speaking of which, is there anything in terms of the development process of Mythborn that anyone can actually check out, or is it just the books for now, if they wanted to do a search?
Yeah, so that's a great question. If you go to www.mythbornmedia.com, mm-hmm. I'm constantly sort of trying to update that website. Right now, it's just the books, but we are putting up. I have a channel called Mythborn Live mm-hmm. on YouTube, and I do two broadcasts every week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Currently at 3 p.m. Eastern time, but we're gonna be moving that to probably a little later in the evening, just mm-hmm. because people have been asking me to do it later so they can watch it when they get home. Okay. So. But I think that, you know, if you want to know about Mythborn, if you want to know about Elder Scrolls, video game development, writing, what's coming up, all these other things, my Mythborn Live channel, which feeds into www.mythbornmedia.com, but if you just Google Mythborn Live on YouTube, you'll see it. And I think I have 50 videos up there or 40-something videos up there now. I mean, but 30 of Mythborn Live and then some others that are just, you know, ancillary videos that I've taken while I was getting ready for Mythborn Live. You know, that's a great resource to find out what's going on. And frankly, if you're interested in gaming or writing, it's a great resource for you just to learn, because I'm just giving away knowledge that, you know, will help you be a better writer or a better video game developer. Or, you know, if you like what you have. Like when you hear, call, write me, and I'll help you by contacting someone and seeing if they want to see your resume.
That's really useful. That's super wholesome.
Something funny that I don't know if you read the Mythborn books, they have a little saying at the beginning of each chapter, and they're based on all the learnings and various teachings I've had. I grew up actually in Bangkok, Thailand. Moved here when I was 10 years old.
Oh, was that just for business reasons, or why were you over there?
My dad was a doctor teaching at the University of Bangkok, and I was actually, I grew up there. And so English was my third language when I got here. Oh,
okay.
And even weirder, here's a small joke. It's all about timing, right? Mm-hmm. So I ended up coming from the South China Sea around 7 or 8 years old to Madison, Wisconsin. And I thought that Americans must have been the greatest warriors in the world because they wore because they wore blades on their feet. I had no idea those were ice skates.
You thought that they stabbed people with them?
these kids would come to school with their ice skates over their shoulders. And I didn't know that there was a recess where you went ice skating. Like, I'm like, oh, boy. They got boots with blades?
Yeah, I never really pictured that as a weapon. You should almost make an Easter egg in the Mythborn game where someone has a pair of skates that they can use to stab people.
Dude, that's a great idea. That'd be a great weapon. Blades of kicking or something, right?
Yes.
Oh, you heard it here first, folks. Yeah.
Lars, you're a visionary.
I absolutely am. The one of the members of the chat thinks you should call it the Blades of Glory.
I love that movie. That's a great idea. Yeah. Done.
Yeah, we've actually talked about that a couple of times. That's a good movie.
Done.
Yeah. So just out of technical curiosity, if you were aiming for a release at some point, would that be on the PC, consoles, or
only on the mobile phone?
Yeah.
So, actually, just so you guys know, it's a much more sort of detailed rollout plan. So first, I'm right now in discussions with the Amazon group to build an interactive storyteller for Mythborn. So remember back in the 80s when you could read like a choose your own adventure book?
Ah.
So I'm building a choose your own adventure Mythborn book for the Alexa, right? So Alexa will tell you, you walk into a room and blah, 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 blah. Do you pick up the sword or do you open the door? And then you choose, you tell Alexa go on, then she reads you the next stage of the story. And so, you know, that's the first sort of experiment we're working on. The second one is shortly following that, I want to create a mobile game based on the 1984, I think, version of Joust. So imagine, one of the characters I have, or creatures I have in my book is called, are their Wingblades. And Wingblades are basically these sort of raptor-like creatures that the elves ride, and they have sickle feet, and they're super fast, and they can cut people and kill people. And the elves use them basically to fight the undead as part of the book, in the book. And I wanted to create a big gladiatorial version of that where there's lots of different mounts, dragons, wyverns, you know, these wing blades, other things, and also big upgrades to the knights, their armor, what they wear, their magic weapons upgrades, and do a side-scrolling parallaxed version on mobile, iPad, iPhone, that lets people sort of engage at that level, on the Mythborn level. And then, in the meantime, in parallel production, because an RPG will take at least 18 months, I have a lot of friends in the gaming industry, and some of them are very, very well placed at great studios like Black Isle, Fergus, or Black Isle, and other people that I know. And you know, I've been writing out the design of Mythborn, the role playing game, the survival role playing game, and just so people understand. These documents are, you know, they can be hundreds of pages long. And my goal is to ultimately partner with someone based on the success of those first two things and then start developing this third thing, which would probably, we'd be looking at 2020 in getting it out. So it's not around the corner, but it's short in game development time, just so you know.
Okay. I think you made a wise decision there, by the way, where instead of just announcing Diablo Immortal, you also announced Diablo 4. Like, you actually have the big title for people to look forward to, and you're doing some experiments on the side. That's cool. I never begrudge a game developer for doing that. That's fine. But I also want like the big thing to look forward to.
Yeah, I agree with you. One of the ideas I had was I wanted to look at your Amazon profile and look at all the things you've bought. If you're a Prime member, obviously. And then I wanted to have a converter that would convert all the things you've bought in the last 6 months into fantasy gear.
Wow, that's a cool idea.
Yeah. And then you can use that gear, right? While you're yep. playing. That, it'd be really cool, right?
Especially if it was ice skates.
I've never heard of that concept before, though. That's a new one. That's a brand new one.
How would you adapt it if somebody bought like something that's not easily adaptable, you know,
like 50 Shades of Grey? Like, they'd have no idea right? what to do with it.
So in order to circle back, I think there are many reasons to use 50 Shades of Grey as a tome of knowledge. But that's how I adapt that. But I will say that, you know, not everything has to convert Exactly. In fact, I think it's better in a way if Amazon can use a label that says Mythborn ready on any item they have so that people are more incented to buy certain items versus others.
Ah, so it can kind of contribute to their experience in the game as well.
Right. And that's where business and creativity come together. And, you know, I mean, I've always been sort of congratulated and helped forward because I have a, you know, I have a way of looking at things that most people don't. And I think this is one of those things where, I mean, I'm sure it's public and it's on radio, but I think it's going to be where things go anyways. It's not going to be, you know, just my own idea. People are going to come up still with the algorithms that create how a lighter becomes, you know, flint and tinder. And, you know, yeah. What is your, when you buy a mouse on Amazon, a mouse pad or whatever, what does that become, right? I mean, yeah. There's still some fun creativity there and how we create.
Maybe like a rug. A rug in a room.
Or a hairpiece.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. It doesn't have to be a good hairpiece.
What about a face tattoo?
In all seriousness, no. So there was this game back on the classic iPod called Song Summoner, The Unsung Heroes. This is basically the only thing that's even remotely close to your idea, which is you could, it was a strategy RPG where it would listen to the songs that you had on your iPod, and it would listen to the characteristics of it and create warriors for you. And I remember thinking, that was a really original idea. And I kind of feel like there's room there for things that people didn't even know they wanted, is a way that I would put it. So I encourage you to develop that as intricately as you can. I would look forward to checking that out.
Well, the reason why I want to do it on the Alexa first is my, you know, ultimate goal is it's all about building a technology and then having it tested and then refining it. And so from, you know, the Alexa app going to Joust and adding the ability for you to use barcodes to create certain items. So when you're in a grocery store and you're scanning things, maybe that creates items for you. And then taking it to the next level from there to Mythborn, you know, when we do the CRPG, to whatever we might want to do, like either it's, you know, your camera recognizes items you have on your desk, you can just take pictures of it. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity right now with the Internet of Things to satisfy people's everyday activities and show them a value within a fantasy world of the things they would always do anyways.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the only reason I ever lost, I lost 65 pounds once in 3 months. And
that's really fast.
Yeah. Well, I'm a fighter, so I know how to do it. But the reason I lost it was because I made sure that everything I wanted to do was at the end of a bike ride. Right? And that's what I'm talking about utilitarianism, right? So, you know, I stopped driving to work. I would just ride my bike 13 miles to work. And that made a big difference because I had to be at work. You know, there's a reward at the end. And I think writing novels is the same way. Everything is the same. It's like you got to put something at the end to satisfy our innate desire to be rewarded and to be valued. And I think that's the key. That's the key to making someone love gaming, right? Is to give them some touch points to feel good about themselves in an inherently guilty activity, which is I'm playing a game.
I remember when I played Watch Dogs 2 a couple years ago, it was basically an entire game about the Internet of Things. And, you know, there are some sinister implications to it that can happen, but it ultimately just made me think, you know, the Internet of Things, which if people aren't aware of what that is, it's stuff like your smartphone, smart house, smart light switches, you know, your Alexa, your Google Home, all that stuff is all connected to the internet, and there is untapped potential there. We have not even begun to see what we can do with it, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that the world is changing every day. I had a friend who once told me, I can't take credit for this, but someone said to me, every second of every day, a person who never played games dies, and a person who's only going to play games is born.
Ah, interesting. And the author of that quote is Vijay Lakshman, right?
No, I can't take credit for that.
Okay. Yeah, just kidding.
It's a bit morbid. It's a bit morbid.
Yeah. We'll pretend that it was you who said it. That's fine.
That's fine.
By the way, Vijay, I could talk for hours myself. I think Joe is probably of a similar mindset, and I feel like the fans would love to hear more, but we also want to keep about a tight hour, what are we at right now? An hour and a half, just for the sake of the audience.
Sure.
We don't want to give them like a 5-hour podcast,
I do.
Although we would definitely be open to you coming back at some point if we have a lot more questions to get to.
Yeah, let's do that. That'd be great.
Great, sure, yeah. But in the meantime, Joe, is there anything that you just really, really wanted to ask that you just hadn't gotten an opportunity to yet?
Yeah, what was the original Elder Scrolls arena? What language was it written in?
English?
No. He's saying computer language. So so Julian was a pretty badass at assembly. Like, I used to stand over his shoulder and watch him do assembly so fast that it was like 60 or 70 lines per second, like, you know, whatever the words per second.
You do,
it would just be like, it would be flowing up the page faster than I could sort of read it, except for like pushes and pops and AX registers and whatever. And then he would stop, he would like put a finger on his head, and then he would go up like 100 lines and change one push to a pop, right? And then he would come back down to where he was. I had no idea how he kept it all in his head. Like, I really, truly don't know how he did it. So, you know, he was a Z80 guy, on like kernel level programmer guy. So I want to say that he did it all in assembly, but what we ought to do, maybe, is have both of us on next time. And, you know, he lives not even 10 miles from me, and we stay in touch all the time. And so he will be part, I guarantee you, of the Mythborn team when we start coding the full time thing. So it'll be the gang, you know, the band getting back together, right? So, you know, but you know, have him on. We can ask him the technical questions, and I'll just sit by and look pretty like a flower.
Absolutely.
Sure. I mean, if we can keep it not too dry, because I don't know anything about coding myself. So,
dude, he's hilarious. He sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's like, "Hello, I'll tell you everything you want to know."
Okay.
Okay. He's hilariously funny too. Very dry, yeah. Very good sense of humor.
Yeah, and there was an interesting joke that I think flew over our heads at first that Chris just pointed out, which is that you mentioned looking pretty, and this is an audio podcast, so that's completely irrelevant.
I figured, oh, but boy. I didn't want to jump back in and go, "Hey, did you guys notice I just said something?"
One other question that Chris is wondering.
Yeah, Chris is our assistant, by the way. He was going to be on this call, but his audio quality is having some issues. I want to give him at least one question.
Yeah.
He's wondering, what advice would you give to other writers and creators in terms of staying in a creative and focused mindset?
That is a great question. I'm going to answer you very seriously with no jokes. So every day I write 1,500 words. I never let myself not write 1,500 words. It could be 1,500 thes in a row. It never is, but it could be. The point is, I write every day. The same way that someone who's going to be running runs every day, or someone who's going to, you know, get big lifts every day. Like, you have to, your writing is a muscle. It is not a talent that is somehow gifted to some and not to others. The fact is this: when you start out, if you want to be creative every day, because when you start with the mechanics of being creative, which is things like grammar or things like, if you're an artist, you know, brush strokes, or whether these are pen or pencil or colors. But pretty soon, if you keep doing it, you see past the mechanics and you start creating. The creation of things is not in the weeds. The weeds disappear once you understand what weeds look like and once you're used to them. And they go away, and what you then see is the way in which you can create a tapestry of beauty by thinking bigger. And that bigger thought, that bigger view, it only comes from practice. So, hey, listen, it's not easy. If it was, everyone would do it. It's not easy for me to write 15 hours a day. I got two kids. I got a whole life, you know, that interrupts all the time. And for the last 7 years, I've woken up at 5 a.m. and I write for 2 hours. And, you know, it is not easy. But if that's what you want to do, just go do it, right? Get those 1,500 words in every day and you'll be a great writer. Get the art time in. You'll be a great artist. Get the coding time in. You'll be a great coder.
Yeah, I'm actually doing that right now with 3D computer-generated imagery and rendering. I suck at it, and I'm just trying to get better, so I do a little bit every day. And, you know, I just try to render something and have a result, and I'm getting better over time. You got to get those, as we've talked about before, those 10,000 hours.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You're the only way to do it.
It's just like driving, right?
Yeah. Well, I would hope you could drive before 10,000 hours of it.
Think about it. 10,000 hours of driving is about 5 years.
That's true.
And look, and think about this, right? That's when your insurance rates go down. Statistically, from 15 years old, 9 months, to 21 is your first step down on your insurance. And then the next one, when is it? 5 years later, 26. Because from 15 to 21, you can't get 8 hours a day in driving. It actually, for driving, takes 10 years, right? Because you don't drive 8 hours a day.
Yeah, unless you're insane. Yeah.
Yeah, unless you're insane, right? So, look, I mean, hey, just look at actuarials in insurance, and you'll see exactly where they think expertise happens.
So it's kind of a driving force in the universe. So, okay, I have one more question from the audience. This is just to be a quick one. Okay. Have you ever read Ready Player One?
Read it? No, I watched the movie.
What did you think of it?
I liked it. Feel a little bit like I might have missed some of the more important parts because I was there with a bunch of friends and we were sort of talking in the middle and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I have it. I bought it. I'm going to watch it again. My initial impression was it could be pretty, it seemed pretty good. I love the references to various video games. But, you know, again, I didn't watch it closely enough to do a judgment call, but my thumb would be more up than down on it right now.
I don't know. I hear good things about
the book.
The book. I do intend to get around to it myself at some point.
I'll pick it up.
I have too much to do.
I'll definitely pick it up. I love reading. I read all the time. I've read 2,000 or 3,000 fantasy novels and science fiction novels at this point. So,
have there been any interesting games that you've been playing recently yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I have somewhat, I guess, fallen in love with Path of Exile.
I played that. It's pretty good.
I am a level 60 dude on there. I have three characters that are all level 60 to level 40, so I haven't finished it. But, you know, if I look at my library, you know, I like Path of Exile because of a big reason is, they, in my mind, they have done a great job in solving that money sink, not in the game world, because they don't throw a lot of money at you in the game world, but in letting you, the player, gear out your character from a visual standpoint based on real money. What a genius way to go about giving people who want to put money into upgrading their character a way to do it without, like, screwing all the people who don't have money and want to just play, right? I think that's just sort of genius, right? I love that. It's older now, so I mean, this is old news. Everyone who knows this knows this. I love Subnautica. I played that death.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that's a great game. For people who aren't familiar with that, basically it's an indie game where you crash land on an alien planet that's almost completely submerged, and you basically just have to survive. And you meet all sorts of weird creatures and stuff. A couple people in the audience are saying that they've played this game too.
It's well loved
by people who have actually played it. The cool thing I really liked about that game in particular is that it's like the creatures are completely fantastic, but they kind of make sense within the ecosystem.
Right.
Like, they don't feel out of place. They just feel bizarre compared to what we're used to on Earth. So it's just a really cool concept. I can't recommend it enough. I've done YouTube videos on it myself. I like to reward developers for doing something different, and that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. And then, you know, I could go on for hours on that. So, but the last one, I don't want to take up, you know, too much time there. I am a huge fan of XCOM 2. Like, I literally forever have been thinking about making a turn-based, tactical, squad-based CRPG. Like, literally, my mind is split right now in the middle of, should I do a survival RPG for Mythborn or a turn-based, party-based, tactical RPG for Mythborn using sort of the XCOM system?
You could do Mythborn Tactics as well, though. Like, you could
do... Yeah, I
could
do both. Right, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, really, I'm thinking about which one should I do first. And so, And then finally, I've been playing RimWorld a lot. And RimWorld's, you know, it's on Steam. It basically is you crash land on a planet and you have to build a colony. It's also a sort of survival game, but it's sort of old school pixel graphics.
Looking at it now.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. It's been really great, mainly because of the incredible amount of sort of upgrades the community has done, and just the level of support and the amount of freedom you have in that particular world. I like Terraria, which is sort of like RimWorld, except Terraria is 2D, I mean, side-scrolling, and
yeah.
RimWorld is, you know, top-down. They're both sort of the same game to me, in a way, but I have not played either one long enough to say they're the same game, but initially I've been experimenting with them because of my desire to understand what are the motivators behind building a survival RPG for Mythborn, even though Mythborn would be 3D, first person or third person in the world. And the final thing I just downloaded yesterday was the Universe Sim.
And that just sort of
went to, you know, a thing. And so you build a planet and you're looking at that a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, look, I play everything. Kerbal Space Program, Homeworld, Hard West, Hand of Fate. I love Battlestar Galactica. I think the Battlestar Galactica, you know, remake sort of. Actually, I worked on the Battlestar Galactica game when I was at Universal, and then they remade it into a turn-based sort of, you know, tactical Battlestar to Battlestar capital ship, to, you know, attack. And, you know, I love that, you know, but Fractured Space, wow, what great graphics there if you, you know, play. Dude, I'm a serious gamer, so I play everything. And you know what, frankly, you know, or Everspace, right? Frankly, though, if you think about this, that's my job, right? My job is to know this stuff and to play it. So, yeah. So, you know, I can't claim that I am somehow doing anything but trying to keep up with, you know, these amazing people out there who have great creativity.
One game I might recommend to you if you're looking for research for, you know, the survival genre in terms of making your Mythborn dreams come to life is Factorio. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't.
Okay. That was like the next thing on the list that I thought you were going to say. Basically you just, so it's a little bit different. It's, you crash land on this place where there's just resources and stuff. And the idea of the game is that you want to survive, but you also want to thrive. And by doing that, you start out the game, you know, going around with a pickaxe and getting metal and resources and then burning it for energy, but then you start to build systems that automate that process for you. So you have like a you have conveyor belts and stuff where you can mine the ore, and then it'll go down to your burner, and then that's your first machine, and they become more complex over time, like exponentially so. And it's not my favorite game, but it's definitely one of the more interesting takes on that genre. I know people put like thousands of hours into it. They just get hopelessly addicted. So that might give you some insight.
I have it. And I have not played it, mainly because it's still in early access. And yeah. I've been wondering, like, do I want to start? Okay, so just so everyone understands, and my heart goes out to game developers here, but this is to the audience. You really need to understand that, like, we work on games for up to 18 to 24 months, right? That's 2 years. And the game isn't fun until the last 10%, when it's awful to fun very quickly. But that awful to fun period is at your lowest ebb of sort of patience with the game. Like, you live this game every day. Imagine chicken for literally 24 months, and then at the 22nd month, they're like, okay, now make it tasty. Oh. Like, you've tried everything, right? At that point, you tried everything. So you're literally at wit's end to make this thing work. And and there's so many dials to turn that could make things good or bad. That's why, in my opinion, bad game companies try and shorten that period, whereas good game companies, they lengthen that period. They let the game have time to mature through testing, because testing is where you find out where things are fun. It's not in the features. It's in the testing.
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%. I always say, like, when a game gets delayed, that's usually a good sign. Like, to when people need more time to make it a better product, I'm like, good for them. Like, I'd rather they not rush something out. And, you know, sometimes it turns out to be that, you know, it just sucks anyways. But in a lot of cases, like, the extra time does show. It feels more polished.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like launching a book without an editor.
Yeah.
No one does that. No one who's smart. I did it once. It was horrible. You need an editor to tell you what you can't see anymore because you've looked at it too long.
Yeah. Joe and I have talked about that before, about recording the show, where it's like with comedy, you have to trust your first reaction to it. Because I edit the podcast, when I listen to a joke that we did like 1,000 times, I'm like, this isn't funny. This is stupid. But the truth is, like, the first time I heard it, I'm like, that was hilarious. So yeah, it's like you can get too into your own head about it at some point. So I know what you mean.
One of the secrets that I used to do when I was developing games was, and I, you know, at first I'd get a little bit, you know, panned on this, but I would tell my team, I'm not going to look at the game until, you know, way later in the process. And they'd all get mad. They'd be like, well, you're the expert game designer, blah, blah, blah. Why aren't you giving us feedback? And literally, it's like you want me to look at the eggs and the green pepper and the ham and the sausage before it's an omelet. It doesn't matter what I think about each of those individual components. It's not until they're all in the pan together and working that I can actually measure whether or not you made an omelet or you made scrambles or you made crap. Right? And it's like, it's useless for me to evaluate each of those individual components by themselves.
Yeah.
There are much better people on the teams, the leads. That's why we hire leads, like a lead programmer, lead artist, lead designer. Those people have that mentality. They got to look at each individual component, make sure it's right. But my job as the overall architect is not to get buried in details. It's to have that bigger view and say, well, how does all this come together? And does it work?
In summary, you got to fry it up and then take a look at it.
Yep. The problem is when everyone smells omelets, they want to ship it. Yeah. They're not sure if it's burned or not. They're just like, hey, I smelled an omelet. Let's ship.
All right, so I think we're going to try to cut it off about a half an hour ago, and then, we kept talking because it was fun and natural and organic, but I think I'm going to cut it off here as the editor, because this is going to take a billion years to pare down.
But, I smell an omelet.
I've thoroughly enjoyed my time talking to you, BJ. You've been a blessing to have on the show.
Me too, thank you very much for coming on.
Guys, I want to thank you so much. I'm honored and humbled to be on the show, and I want to thank you guys for inviting me and for hosting me. Thank you.
And once again, if people wanted to find your YouTube channel, what was that called again?
My YouTube channel is Mythborn Live. It's Mythborn, MythBorn, Mythborn Live, LIVE with an exclamation point. And then they can also check out Mythborn. They can, if they Google Mythborn, they're going to get a dozen places.
And that's going to do it, I think, for another exciting episode of the first podcast. Today we were talking to VJ Lakshman, creator of Elder Scrolls Arena. influencer on Elder Scrolls 2 Daggerfall. Huge nerd who reads a lot of books, writes a lot, and has a lot of great plans for the future when it comes to Mythborn. I'm excited to check out the games when they come out. If you want to follow us on social media, you can go to our Linktree. Joe, can you give the Linktree?
Yes, absolutely. It's going to be linktr.ee/T1podcast. And that's where you'll find all their links to Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Play. And
as well as our social media links, our Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, regrettably, are all on there. And we also have a Patreon. If you've enjoyed your time and you'd like to listen to more, you'd like to help with our success as a show, that's patreon.com/T1podcast. I'm going to sign off. Once again, thanks for being here, and goodbye.
Well, I'm going to fill up my water cup. See ya.